Morning.
Morning.
So this morning I'm going to talk about bodhisattvas. Our closing chant every Sunday is a bodhisattva vow chant. Bodhisattva vow. Beings are numberless, vowing to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it. Simple. Simple. Chanted all over the world in whatever the language may be at Zen temples, and Zen monasteries, and Zen centers. So bodhisattvas, so those of us who are committed to this path are bodhisattvas. We're bodhisattvas in training. We'll be bodhisattvas in training for our whole lives. And bodhisattva means awake being. We're awake. We're aspiring to wake up and not be caught by all this garbage. Very simple. Just not be caught by all this garbage. Sometimes you may think this garbage is valuable. and it does have some value, but mostly it's just refuse. Mostly it's just refuse, and we don't need it. We just don't need it. So we're trying to wake up to our interconnectedness with everyone, with everything, which this garbage stays in the way of. Stays in the way of that feeling. The interconnection's always there. But the garbage gets in the way, gucks things up. And we're trying to help other people awaken to their own still nature, to their own interconnected nature. So as bodhisattvas, in the midst of entanglement, which is our emotional, intellectual, psychological suffering, we do our best to connect with others and feel some deep joy when we connect with others, of serving others, of supporting others. So that's bodhisattva in a nutshell. And Deb just heard this talk, so she can give it herself. No, she says she doesn't want to give it herself. So the three bodhisattvas I'm going to talk today about are four of our main bodhisattvas. Manjusri Bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, Maitreya Buddha Bodhisattva, and Samantabhadra Bodhisattva. So in Buddhist temples all over the world, Mahayana Buddhist temples, whether they're Zen or not, well, particularly if they're not Zen, there is chanting in which you give yourself away to the bodhisattvas and the Buddhas. You give yourself away to this greater power, higher power that manifests itself in, and whether they're actual spirits or gods or what, but in particularly in devotional Buddhism, they're very important. There, and that's called tariki in Japanese Buddhism. Tariki, other power. They're out there. This is very much like 12-step. We're incapable of self-salvation. We can't do it. We give ourselves away to these other beings, to these other powers, by chanting their name and seeking their compassionate power. We empty ourselves out. We give ourselves away. That's tariki. And then there's jiriki, which is Zen. Jiriki in Zen is self-power. So in Japanese Buddhism and also in Chinese Buddhism, all the different terms, there's tariki and jiriki. Jiriki, we think, oh, this energy is inside us, actually. It's just inside us. We sit zazen, we see the garbage, we let go of it, and the bodhisattvas manifest themselves within us. They're here. Their power's right here. And a self-power. We sit in this cushion. moment after moment, day after day, decade after decade, lifetime after lifetime. Sometimes we sit straight, sometimes we fall over. As we get older, we have trouble. At least I have trouble sitting straight. But still, I'm pretty straight. And you don't see me because you've got your face to the wall. I'm not as straight as you think. But everything's getting crooked. My spine's, well, we won't get into that. But it's jiriki. We access the energy to express this archetypes within us, this archetypal energy within us of these four bodhisattvas. And of course, there are more. But I don't have that much time today. I'm not talking about Kishti Garba. I'm not talking about Jiso. I'm not talking about a few of the others. Anyway, so Tariki and Jiriki. And I talked last week about being in Hindu temples in southern India and hearing Hindu temples which are very devotional. Very devotional, devoting themselves to these gods and goddesses and beings that are in the ether. And I talked about hearing them call out, Ma, Ma, Ma. And it just brought tears to my eyes because they were so devoted, they were so giving themselves away that I felt that. There's Tariki power at its best, at its most poignant, at its most sincere. But anyway, we're Jiriki guys. We do some Tariki stuff, but basically we're Jiriki guys. We say the energy is here. It's parts of ourselves that we have forgotten about or overlooked, or our culture has dissed them, or our parents dissed them, or we dissed them, or something. So we have a very interesting phenomena that occurred in the 13th century in Japan. We have two guys coming along, one guy named Dogen and another guy named Shinran. And Dogen is our ancestor. We're sitting here today doing Zazen partly because of him. He's pivotal. He's pivotal. And 10 years after he was born, there was a guy named Shinran born. Shinran is the founder of Shin Buddhism. Katagiri Roshi, who was my teacher, was raised a Shin Buddhist. Those are other power Buddhists. They just recite Buddha's name over and over again and give themselves away to him so that they can live with a sense of intimacy with everyone. So one is giving yourself away to these powers out there. The other is letting go of all of this stuff in here. But actually, the effects are the same. If you really do it, the effects are the same. When you let go of all this crud in here, you access something huge. When you give yourselves away, say, I'm no good, well, I wouldn't do that too much because that's not so healthy. But anyway, if you do that in a healthy way, you discover the same energy. So we practice, our Buddhist practice, our Zen practice, is to awaken these energies and these qualities. And in our meal chants, which I put at the front of your program, every time we do a meal, we say, Maitreya Buddha, future birth, Manjusri Bodhisattva, great wisdom, Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, great activity, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, great wisdom. So it seems like we're actually doing more of a Shin practice. Doesn't matter what you call it. Doesn't matter what you call it. And you could say that we're just invoking that energy that's always here. You could say that. So now I'll talk about each of them a little bit. And I'll start by talking about Manjusri, who's up there, whom I've talked about a lot. And Manjusri is In any Zen temple, I haven't checked all the Zen temples in the world, but in most Zen temples, Manjushri is the guy who's on the altar. And you can check him out anytime. He usually has a sword. This Manjushri is kind of wimpy. He doesn't have his sword, but he usually has a very sharp sword, and he's resting on a lion, right? So with his sharp sword, he's cutting through all that garbage, helping us cut through all that garbage in our heads, in our hearts, in our minds, surrounding our heart. Not in the deepest place of our, in the deepest part of our heart, there's no garbage. In the middle of our mind, there's no garbage, but he's helping us cut away everything so that we can return to this original stillness that we all have. And he's sitting on a lion because he's courageous. To sit zazen for a whole day or a whole hour or a whole week. Some of you are going to come down to Hokkyoji with Susan and me, and we're going to sit for 5 days. That takes some courage. It doesn't take courage if you're going to sit and space out the whole time. But if you're really going to do the practice, it takes courage. It takes courage. So he's courageous. And the sword is reminding us just to keep returning, just to keep coming back every time we get caught. Every time we get caught. And Manjushri is the male manifestation of Prajnaparamita. Prajnaparamita is the mother of all Buddhas. Manjushri is considered the teacher of all the Buddhas, including the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. So he's about helping us empty out and return to zero. Return to zero. I haven't used that term, return to zero, in a while, because last time I used it, someone said to me, "Boy, that seems cold, returning to zero. I don't think I want to do that." But I want to tell you, it's very warm. It's very warm, because at zero, when you let go of all this crud, that zero, it's a big circle that includes everyone and everything. It's very warm. It may seem cold while you're cutting it away with your sword. It may seem arduous. It may seem difficult. But when you really cut it away and open up to it, it's warm. Money back guaranteed. So Manjushri is usually very youthful looking. This Manjushri is a little older than most Manjushris. Maybe he's been having a harder time with too many students. I don't know. Usually very youthful because he's prajna. That's wisdom. He's pra before jna means knowledge. So he's youthful because it's before knowledge. It doesn't dis knowledge. It's just before it. Just before it. Bumper sticker I saw, "Don't believe what you think." That's Manjushri. Don't believe what you think. Thinking is cool, but don't believe it. So Manjushri is helping us practice here in our zazen, in our meditation, so that our thinking no longer screens us off from this energy of life that's cursing through us. Wonderful energy. And Manjushri is known for using language to point to non-dual understanding. He's considered a master of speech. He helps us realize being just who we are and feeling supported by everyone and everything. Just because things are, because we are in this intimate relationship with all life. We just are. Just the way things are. So Manjushri is also the Bodhisattva of the Prajnaparamita Sutras. Those are the wisdom that goes beyond sutras. That would be the Heart Sutra, the different versions of the Prajnaparamita Sutra, and the Diamond Sutra. And here's a quote from dialogue with Manjushri in the Prajnaparamita Sutra of 30,000 lines. How should one abide in the paramita of wisdom, Manjushri? Manjushri answers, abiding in nothing is abiding in the paramita of wisdom. Why is abiding in nothing abiding in this paramita? Because to have no notion of abiding is to abide in the paramita of wisdom. Very simple. Very simple. So Susan is going to be leading a study group on the Diamond Sutra, which is a wonderful compilation of Prajnaparamita Sutras, teachings. And I think it's starting, when's it starting? Okay, I have something. Yeah. So if you want to delve into Manjushri's cutting sword rather than in addition to sitting, and then go for it. So Manjushri is also lean of speech. He thinks, how are my words going to help? How are they going to hinder? He's eloquent. He's skillful in language. He helps us let go of all our fixed views and being pinned down to any one view. So here's Bob Dylan. The country music station plays soft, but there's nothing, really nothing, to turn off. So we don't try to turn it off. We just cut our identification with it. Just let it pass through. It all passes through. Different tunes passing through. No need to turn any of them off. Okay, so that's Manjushri. Avalokiteshvara, I have handouts, you guys. Handouts. I have a color printer now at home. I had to ask my wife how to do this. The next time I promise I do it myself. So here's Avalokiteshvara. And Avalokiteshvara, and then maybe for the next room, Avalokiteshvara. Can someone give Avalokiteshvara to the next room? And so Avalokiteshvara is the most well-known of the bodhisattvas. Kuan Yin, Kanzion, all over Asia, and now all over the United States. So, there she is. There he is, taking a multiplicity of forms, attentive to the world's cries, right? Attentive to the world's cries, cares enough to listen completely to what is, to the pain, to the fear, to the despair that other people are experiencing, the sadness, the joy, the confusion, the serenity, paying attention to it. Including yourself, not leaving yourself out. Androgynous. He, she is androgynous. He, she has a multiplicity of arms and legs and eyes. Because you have to if you're going to be there for all beings. Anyway, you just do. We just do. So, skillful means, Avalokiteshvara decides what arm to use in a given situation to help someone. What arm, which legs to use, which eyes to use, just depending on people's needs. My friend Patrick, 20 years ago, began going to the homeless camps. I mentioned this last time. I hadn't talked about this in a few years, but enough of you are new that I thought I can do this again. He began going to the homeless camps. He worked at a drop-in center for people with mental illness in northern Minnesota. And what did he do when he went there? He just listened. He just was with them. He just was respectful? Did he try to get them to do something different, to be some different? Did he try to teach them? No. He just listened to their pain. He listened how they were dealing with their drug dependency, how they were dealing with their minds that was out of control. He just listened. And of course, what happens when you just listen, when you deeply listen, is that people respond. People respond. So he told me he had to go to the camps, the same camp, 4 or 5 times. And finally, by the 5th time, if he just listened every time, they began to open up. They began. Now, if he started sort of saying, giving them advice, they shut down. But he learned right away. That's Avalokiteshvara. She just listens. She just feels. She's there with other people suffering, and they experience it. They experience it. And it's good. It's good. So, that's Avalokiteshvara. That's Avalokiteshvara. And I've said many times it's different from idiot compassion. With idiot compassion, we identify with someone's pain so much that our identity becomes to take care of them. There's no Manjushri there. Manjushri has to be the first one in all Zen practice. Because without Manjushri, we so easily get into idiot compassion, or we get into anxious compassion. Anxious compassion. Like my aunt, who's wonderful, but and the deceased, and Margaret, I apologize, but you are wonderful. But when my son was tiny, a baby, he was colicky, and so he had trouble sleeping through the night. And we lived in kind of a rural part of California where we had a lot of little mice running around. They were just little tiny mice. They ran around, and he was on a pretty high crib. But Margaret, when she came to visit us, would stay awake all night worrying that the mice were going to keep Jed awake. And Jed would end up sleeping better than Margaret, much better, because Margaret, her compassion was fraught with anxiety. Fraught with anxiety. And that's what she didn't know, Manjushri. Didn't know Manjushri. So in Manjushri, we don't believe in our thinking. But we entertain our thinking. We enjoy it. It has practical. There's practical purpose. Really good practical purpose. But we don't ultimately believe in it. Not ultimately. Not in the middle. Not right here. And we can accept without judgment whatever's arising. And little by little, we develop that capacity by opening up to our Manjushri energy and our Avalokiteshvara energy, our compassion energy. So let's do a short meditation, a short Avalokiteshvara meditation. I'm going to do short meditations for three of these. I don't know, three of these maybe. I don't know. So just take your ease, just breathe in and breathe out easily, and I'll repeat some things, and you can either repeat them to yourselves or listen to my voice, or just be here. This is a Avalokiteshvara, very short meditation. May I feel safe and secure. May I feel safe and secure. May I be compassionate toward my mistakes. May I be compassionate toward my mistakes. May I be compassionate toward my negative emotions. May I be compassionate toward my negative emotions. May I be compassionate toward myself. May I be compassionate toward myself. May I be compassionate toward my friends. May I be compassionate toward my friends. May I be compassionate toward others. May I be compassionate toward others. May I be compassionate toward myself. And when you're ready, coming back to the room, and I'll continue talking. Okay, so there's an Avalokiteshvara. There's Avalokiteshvara. I have a Manjushri meditation too, but I see that I'm not going to have time to do that. I'm going to move on to Maitreya. Maitreya is loving kindness and aspiration. And without loving kindness and aspiration, our natural energy of feeling connected is missing. We're self-punitive and or going through the motions like a habit machine. So Maitreya was the first bodhisattva venerated and honored. He's the only one who was actually a disciple of Buddha. Was caring and generous, and he awakens our hope for ourselves and others, for this generation and for future generations. And in other power schools, in Tariki schools, Maitreya is in the Tushita heaven. And we pray that we can go up to be in heaven with him, the Tushita heaven. And there are huge stone statues along the trade routes between India and China. I mean, saying, come Maitreya, come, in some version of Sanskrit. Come Maitreya, come. So Maitreya is inviting us to visualize our current and future lives and others' lives, to be inspired by our hopes, by our dreams. Dogen says, without expressing dreams, there are no Buddhas. Without expressing dreams, there are no Buddhas. So again, Manjushri comes first, because we get all mixed up about our hopes and our dreams, and all that refuse clogs them up. But as our mind gets still, we have aspirations that we haven't acted on. There have been in us for a long time. Each of us has our own. You each have your own. About something you want to do in the short years you have remaining. Even if you're 20, you don't know. So your aspiration, he encourages us to pay attention to that aspiration, to pay attention to our dream. Even if, as Dogen says in Katagiri, he said, it's a dim vision. That doesn't matter. Sure, it's dim. But we all have something we really want to be doing in our heart of hearts. That we want, some way we want to express ourselves in our heart of hearts. We all have that. And it gets pressed down, suppressed, through all this toing and throwing and getting mixed up and being bombarded by sensory stimuli and all of these obligations that we feel we have. Well, of course we have them. We really have them. But. So I'm going to do a second guided meditation now. So, again, just close your eyes three quarters of the way, or maybe all the way for this one. All the way. And take a couple of nice deep breaths. feel your body. Feel your body. And move up when you're ready into your heart area. Feel the area in your chest around your heart. You could even put your hand on your heart if you wanted to, but you don't need to. Feel your heart. Feel your heart. And when you're ready, you might want to ask yourself, given my experience, given my abilities, given my gifts and skills, what do I really want to do to connect with myself or others at the deepest level? What do I really want to do? What do I really want to do? What's something that I aspire to, that I hope for, in my heart of hearts? What's something that I aspire to, that I hope for, in my heart of hearts? And what might I do to bring this alive? To bring this hope, this aspiration alive. What might I do to bring this hope or aspiration alive? This dream alive. And when you're ready, just come back naturally to the room, opening your eyes. I'll continue talking. So Maitreya Buddha. Maitreya Buddha is considered the father of the Lankavatara Sutra. And Yogacara Buddhism. And one of the founders of Yogacara Buddhism, a guy named Asanga, supposedly meditated for 12 years doing visualizations and devotion to Maitreya, but nothing happened. So then this is typical, he cut the flesh from his own body to give worms to save the life of the dog and worms. And then Maitreya came, well, you guys don't have to do this. You need to be self-compassionate. Too many of you forget the self-compassion. Something about our culture, you didn't imbibe the self-compassion. You need to do the self-compassion, so forget this stuff. Forget it. Forget it. But anyway, it's kind of an interesting story, isn't it? So when he was no longer focused on getting something, well, that's important. When he was no longer focused on getting something, then Maitreya entered his heart. Came right down from Tush to heaven. And he felt Maitreya's unconditional kindness. And then he developed Yogacara teaching. Yogacara teaching. But the way he developed it is that Maitreya took him to Tush to heaven every night for so many nights, teaching him Yogacara, 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 till he had it all down. Then he became a Yogacara teacher. So he taught a sangha about the paramitas, which are part of Yogacara teaching. And if you read Ben Connolly's article in Tricycle, Last Tricycle, The Storehouse Consciousness, he talks about wholesome and unwholesome seeds, and we're placing all this unwholesome garbage in here through our practice of the paramitas: generosity, patience, virtuous behavior, effort, meditation, with wholesome seeds, with wholesome seeds, so that we can wake up to the sixth paramita, which is prajna, which is Manjushri. Manjushri. Who's always here. He's always here. So Maitreya has a loving-kindness attitude in his life. So Maitreya, same word, right? Metta Sutra, same word, Sanskrit, Pali, right? Same person. Loving-kindness meditations. And in China and in Japan, there are characters who are supposed to be incarnations of Maitreya. We've got Putai in China, who is Hote in Japan, who is the fat Buddha that you see in Chinese restaurants. Next time you go into a Chinese restaurant, notice that fat Buddha. You think to yourself, that's not Buddha. The guy is just sitting there with a shit-eating grin and he has this huge belly, right? That's Maitreya. That's Maitreya. Loving kindness, right? Having a good meal, right? With everybody. Inviting everybody into your big belly. Come, Maitreya, come. Well, he's right there, right here. So, Putai Hote is known for wearing ragged clothes and going around with a sack on his back and asking people for a penny to buy oranges, and then filling his pack up with oranges and passing them out to everybody who's indigent and children. And then when his bag's gone, he goes out and gets more pennies and buys more. That's what he does for his whole life, except sit in those Chinese restaurants and enjoy a good meal. Ryokan is considered because Maitreya shows concern for the next generation, shows concern for our kids and our grandkids, shows concern. Maitreya is really concerned environmentally for our kids and our grandkids, really concerned. So Ryokan, 18th century Japanese Zen master, who didn't consider himself a Zen master, hung out with kids a lot, nurtured kids a lot. Here's a poem by Ryokan. At the crossroads this year, after begging all day, I lingered at the village temple. Children gather round me and whisper, "The crazy monk has come back to play. Come back to play." So play, Maitreya. Loving kindness needs to include play, right? It's not a should. It's just there, right? Just there. Poem by Lew Welsh. Lew Welsh, beat poet, friend of Jack Kerouac's, friend of Gary Snyder's, Buddhist, been dead a long time, and these guys did not live very long. Aside from Gary Snyder, they were all dead by the mid-70s. Oh, no, Philip Whalen lived, but most of them were dead. We don't get into that right now. But here's Maitreya poem by Lew Welsh. At last, this is 1967, at last in America, Maitreya, the coming Buddha, will be our leader. And at last, we'll not be powerful and we'll not be alone. Take it as a simple prophecy. Look into the cleared eyes of so many thousands, young, and think, maybe that one. Look out, the secret is looking out. And never forgetting, there are phony ones and lost ones and foolish ones. Know this, Maitreya walks our streets right now. Each one is one, and there are many of them. Look out for him, for her, for them, for these will break America, as Christ cracked Rome. And just tonight, another one got born. Lew Welsh. So the third one, I have about 13 minutes to do the next two, so we'll see what happens. The third one, the last one, I already did. That's the fourth one, right? Yeah, I get mixed up. Oh, I forgot to pass out my tray. Oh, let me pass out my tray. Here's Maitreya in Tush to Heaven. Right here in Tush to Heaven. And then for that room. Here's another Maitreya if somebody wants it. Oh, okay. Oh, that's... this is Samantabhadra. Did I pass out? No, I didn't pass out. There's another Maitreya if anybody wants Maitreya. Do you guys have Maitreya? Oh, okay. All right. Okay. So, Samantabhadra. Samantabhadra, I'll pass out too. All right. Here's another Samantabhadra. There's another Samantabhadra. Samantabhadra is the bodhisattva of activity. And Samantabhadra is riding an elephant. Samantabhadra is calm on his elephant. His elephant and he are steady. They're deliberate. Their activity is unyielding but not aggressive because they're just taking one step. They just take one step, and then another step, and then another step. And to do Samantabhadra well, you need to do Manjushri, because Samantabhadra has a steadiness that comes from knowing how to just to be present in activity and not tossed away by some idea of how you should be. So that's why he's got the elephant supporting him and reminding him and calming him down. Samantabhadra is also difficult to see. He's difficult to see. He acts in the world to help folks with no need or interest in recognition. No need or interest in recognition. My friend Patrick, as I was thinking about this talk, I thought about Patrick, the Avalokiteshvara energy within Patrick, how he could just be there and listen, just be there and listen until they felt like they really trusted him. And then how he got this dim vision, this aspiration that maybe he could be involved in getting them out of the homeless camps so they could live in housing, which was a very unrealistic idea at the time. But he had this aspiration. He kept it with him, and he was able to accomplish it. And then his Samantabhadra activity, he did help these folks a lot. But there was never an article about him in the paper. I knew him because I worked with him. He never asked for any recognition. He never even told people about his work. He just did it. He just did it. He didn't advertise. Well, that's Samantabhadra. And Samantabhadra is the Hua Yan archetype, the Avatamsaka Sutra. Within each pore contains the entire universe. Each pore. Within each eyelash is all of life. All in one, one and all. So, Samantabhadra is especially good for depression. Why? Because when you're depressed, you feel like not doing anything. And yet, if you just do something, that's the best thing for depression. You just do something. You just do something. So that's Samantabhadra energy. That's Samantabhadra energy. And Patrick was depressed. The reason he started going to the homeless camps was because he had insomnia. And he worked at this drop-in center, and he noticed these guys going out, and so he started finding out where they lived, and then they'd be up late at night, so he'd go out there late at night. So in this morning, I'm saying that politically, a Samantar Bhadra guy, and you guys may disagree with this, was Lyndon Johnson. Now, I was not a fan of Lyndon Johnson. I was an avid war protester. But within the course of a few short years, what did Lyndon Johnson do? Here's a list of things I pulled over off of Wikipedia in terms of valuing and nurturing the interdependence. Civil Rights Act of 64 and 68, outlawing most forms of racial segregation and providing equal housing opportunities. Voting Rights of 65, outlawing discriminations in voting. Thurgood Marshall as the first African-American justice on the Supreme Court. Elementary and Secondary Education Act and Higher Education Act to improve funding to schools, especially those in poor districts. National Endowment of the Arts and Humanities, established by Lyndon Johnson to support humanists and artists. Finally, he created programs to tackle poverty, like Head Start. Head Start, that's Lyndon Johnson. Food stamps, that's Lyndon Johnson. There were no food stamps before Lyndon Johnson. Medicare for old people like me, nothing before Lyndon Johnson. Medicaid, Lyndon Johnson. So he's Samantar Bhadra. Now, he could have used these other Bodhisattva's song. You know, none of us is perfect. I would have invited him here to meet Manjusri. But, you know, that's life. We can only do so much. So Manjusri, grounding ourselves in not knowing, doesn't mean we diss our knowledge. We just ground ourselves in not knowing. And then the next one, practicing connecting, Avalokiteshvara, and staying close to those who are suffering, including ourselves, including your own suffering. And then we can move into Maitreya, to some future aspiration. And then we can act on that aspiration, just as an elephant or a turtle. just one step, but we do it with deliberateness, with awareness, and with calmness. And pretty soon we realize it, right? We realize it. All of us. So that's the art of, I'm calling that for today, the art of Zen living. But the art of Zen living, we draw all these energies that are here. Draw them. You can say they're out there and pray to them if you want. That's fine. You can say they're in here, but we draw on them. We draw on them. We work the clay of our confined and anguished existence into bodhisattvas. We work that clay. We play that clay into bodhisattvas. Don't work too hard with that clay. Bring my tray in. Play with that clay. Work play with that clay. Then we're not just this little whimpering self. We're much more. Much more. So I'll close with Whitman. Do I contradict myself? Very well. Then I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. So a little bit of time left. Questions, comments? Anybody? Oh.
You mentioned that self-compassion is something to struggle with as a culture, and I agree.
Uh-huh.
Wondering, in addition to meditation, which is your third, or some other practices or techniques to do that, since it is self-focused, I mean, other than the meditation and the sitting, there's any other.
Well, he's wanting to know if there are other meditations besides. He's acknowledging that self-compassion is difficult for many people in our culture, many, many people. And he's wondering if there are other meditations.
Or to
help. Well, there are lots of meditations. for self-compassion. And I actually did one a while ago here and upstairs about forgiveness and sort of rewiring, forgiving yourself and rewiring. But there are lots of them. And I recommend, you know, you can go online, actually. I haven't done it, but I just assume you can go online and find them. Common Ground also has been teaching a class on self-compassion, which I think filled right up because of this situation that we seem to be in. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
At one point you interchanged Buddha and Bodhisattva.
Yeah.
Done that or had a question about that.
Yeah. Well, Maitreya is a guy who's called sometimes a Buddha and sometimes a Bodhisattva. But, you know, in early Buddhism, the Buddhas were the ones. We all want to awaken to our to be Buddha. But then in Mahayana, we postpone our entry into this great stillness until everybody is in it with us. So we're bodhisattvas. So they are used in somewhat interchangeably because bodhisattvas are all future Buddhas, but they postponed until all the suffering that they feel in the people they know and people they don't know around them has been appeased. So, pretty tall order, huh? Yeah, see, you could start beating yourself up about that, couldn't you? There's so much stuff in religion we can beat ourselves up about. That's why play, Maitreya, play. Work the clay, but play the clay. Play the clay. Lawrence.
I just want to say last week I asked you a question about dancing, but it's feeling disconnected.
About what?
Dancing.
Yeah.
It's feeling disconnected. And I listened to your advice and I kind of sort of put it into play in some ways. I was feeling that I should just be with it and not try to eliminate it.
Uh-huh. And how was that?
Pretty good.
Did you guys hear that? He thought my advice was pretty good. Say that again, Lauren. So
it
can
all... I was feeling disconnected the week before, and when I went last week, I just tried to be with it, not do away with it or anything. I also realized that on the dance floor, I'm not a dancer. But I do clay one on the dance floor.
Okay. Good for you. All right.
Over here.
Yeah, hi.
My name is Cheyenne. I'm an alcoholic and married. And I live in a sober house.
Uh-huh.
I have 9 months of sobriety, and there's been some active use in the sober house.
Uh-huh.
And I came here to get some calm and to get some grounding and some centering.
Mm-hmm.
And to come to a place where I can focus on myself and not take their inventory, but rather kind of like do me, so to speak, and focus back on myself and kind of come to a place where I can like love myself again.
Uh-huh.
And I don't really have a question, but rather a comment. I just wanted to say I read your book, and I wanted to say thank you, because it has been really a pleasure to be surrounded with people, just to kind of come to a place of peace and come to a place where I can feel centered and kind of, I don't know, just peaceful. Like, I feel calm and I feel safe, and that's a big thing too.
Mm-hmm.
As a alcoholic and an addict, mm-hmm. we don't feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice to feel safe with so many people around me.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and I just feel very calm, and I feel like I can go back to my sober house and carry this calmness with me. I carry it in my heart. And that last meditation that you did, you know, I feel like I have a purpose. You know, I feel like I have life. I feel like I have goals
mm-hmm.
that I can strive for now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and I really kind of, I have ideas of my future that I didn't have before. And I just really wanted to say thank you.
Well, you're very welcome, and I hope we get to know you and you come back here many times. Thank you. Thank you very much. So I think I'll close now, and we'll turn this over to Raymond.